All right, so as is our practice, want to do a little bit of a recap and review of what we studied last week in Acts chapter 11, and that'll be a good segue into our beginning of the study of Acts chapter 12 today. Of course, back in Acts 10, we have Peter's vision where he was given the sheet with the animals, and there in chapter 10 and verse 13 and through 15, the voice came to him saying, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And we understand the gospel then being revealed to the Gentiles from Peter to Cornelius' household. And then in chapter 11, we see the defense of that. And that's what we talked about a little last week. There in chapter 11 and in verse 3, they question, those in Jerusalem question Peter, saying, "You went in to uncircumcised men and ate with them." And so they at that point were not aware of what had happened to Peter, the vision that he had. And so he reveals to them what God had revealed to him there up through verse 9 or so. And we see their reaction to it. And in verse 18, when they heard these things, they became silent. They glorified God, saying, "Then God has also granted to the Gentiles repentance of life." And of course, we understand, through the entire revealed word that we have, that the gospel is for all. And God does not show partiality. We understand that it was revealed, being revealed to the Jews first, and now in our where we are in the New Testament is now being revealed to the Gentiles. And we see the response to it. Many of the Jews were accepting of it. And so we understand they all weren't. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. There in verse 19, they were scattered after that. And, there was a great persecution that arose after, Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch. And they went preaching the word, but the Jews only. So we're seeing more and more persecution that's coming up against the church. And we're seeing much of that persecution is still coming from the Jews. Again, they crucified Christ, they rejected Christ, and they are rejecting his disciples. And that's something that is a continuation. We see the Paul and Barnabas there, Saul and Barnabas. We'll talk about them a little bit later on in our lesson today in chapter 12. But they worked there with the congregation at Antioch, and that's where they were first called Christians. That's where we get our name. It's the only example of a name that we are given as followers of Christ. We're given many descriptions. Disciples of Christ, for example, is something that is used, an adjective used to describe us. But as far as a name, Christian is what they were called first at Antioch. And that's why we use that name today, because the example that we have there in Scripture, and we, of course, understand the significance of that and the meaning of that we are subject to Christ and we are his followers, his disciples. He is our king. All those different ways to describe that relationship that are used throughout the New Testament. And so in chapter 12, we have a continuation of the persecution, an example of the persecution that is arising against Christians and against the church. And so I want to just go ahead and first of all read there verses 1 through 4. To begin our study here in chapter 12. And by the way, we don't have a PowerPoint today. Dad didn't quite get that done before his back went out and hit him. So that's why there's no PowerPoint up there today. But we are still following along with the questions as we do in the lesson book if you do have that. But the first four verses in chapter 12. "Now about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. So when he had arrested him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after the Passover." And so we see here, first of all, the second known Christian martyr, James, that was killed by King Herod there in verses 1 and 2. This is Herod Agrippa, whom we are talking about here and referencing here in the 12th chapter, and that we'll talk about a little bit more as we get in on the with the lesson. Who was the first Christian martyr that we have an example of? Yeah, Stephen. And so we talked about him several chapters before, and of course that was the introduction as well to Saul, because Saul was at the feet holding the garments of those that were stoning Stephen and killing Stephen, making him a martyr. And then, of course, we talked about Paul's conversion. And here we see in chapter 12, the story comes back to Peter, really for one final time, and where until the rest of the book of Acts is pretty much focused on Paul and his journeys. And so we see here that, of course, King Agrippa imprisoned Peter, and the first question that we have is, what was his motivation? What was the motivation here of Herod imprisoning Peter at this time?
It was all political, to please the Jews. So he's focused on his standing as, his political standing, and he knew it would please the Jews to kill James, and then he planned on killing after the Passover, which is why he imprisoned him.
Right, certainly. Yeah, the purely political. Is this something we've seen before? Who did we see this with before? Not everybody wants.
Religiously, but Peter and John were arrested.
Right.
After killing a man.
Certainly. Yeah, and we see that several times. That wasn't the best question. Yeah, Jesus is who I was thinking of in my head, in the sense that the sole reason that Pilate crucified Jesus was upon the pressure, the political pressure of the Jews. Now, Herod here seems to have a disdain for the church that Pilate didn't have. Pilate said, when we look back at those accounts, I find no fault in this man. But still, because of the political pressure there imposed by the Jews at that time, he released to them Barabbas instead of Christ, and he crucified Christ. And so that political pressure was the similarity that I was thinking of in my head. Again, we don't always ask the best questions as teacher, but certainly disciples of Christ have been imprisoned in many other instances. But we see the impact that the Jews had here and the disdain that they had for Christians, just as they, this is a continuation of that hate that they had for Christ. And again, it's because they are now, we've talked about this a little bit throughout Acts as we've looked at the preaching to the Jews and that lack of acceptance. We even, talked about it a little bit last week when we talked about the reluctancy for the Jews at first to accept, that Peter was eating among those that were uncircumcised. They had a special place in their mind, in God's eyes, as being God's chosen people. And of course, under the old law, that was true. But now that things are changing, we see that, I think jealousy is a way that we could describe it. Disdain, anger at times when they go as far as they did with Christ, and we see here with Peter and wanting to persecute these men. That's certainly part of the motivation behind that. And so we see another example of that here. So Peter is in prison. As Rachel said, I think that's important to point out the end goal that Herod had. There's a little bit of speculation here, but I think it's pretty obvious that he was intending to kill Peter as well. When it says there in verse 4 that he was intending to bring him before the people after the Passover, there's really no reason to think that the Jews weren't going to be as excited to see Peter die as they were James and then Jesus beforehand. And so again, we see that ultimate price that the disciples of Christ are having to pay because of their standing for the truth, because of their preaching, because of them, as Peter mentioned earlier in Acts, so that they were compelled to obey God rather than men. And yet they still had that courage. They still had that conviction. Certainly a lesson that we can learn from them and an example. And we'll talk about that persecution a little bit more when we get down to question five. And so to continue on in our reading, I want to go ahead and read, let's see, verses 5 through, let's go verses 5 through 11. 5 through 11. Anybody want to volunteer to read that one? I can read it, but okay, thank you, Dennis.
Peter was therefore kept in prison, but constant prayer was offered to God for him by the church. And when Herod was about to bring him out, that night Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers, and the guards before the door were keeping the prison. Now behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shone in the prison. And he struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, "Arise quickly!" And his chains fell off his hands. Then the angel said to him, "Gird yourself and tie your sandals." And so he did. And he said to him, "Put on your garment and follow me." So he went out and followed him, and did not know that what was done by the angel was real, but thought he saw a vision. When they were past the first and the second guard posts, they came to the iron gate that led to the city, which opened to them of its own accord. And they went out and went down one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. And when Peter had come to himself, he said, "Now I know for certain that the Lord has sent his angel and has delivered me from the hand of Herod and from all the expectations of the Jewish people."
All right, good. So here we see another example of where the Lord intervenes to protect the apostles from that persecution. Again, ultimately, they would lose their lives in the end because of what they stood for. But we see throughout the New Testament that God had a plan for them and had a purpose for them. And that purpose was ultimately fulfilled no matter what man tried to do. I think that's one point to make from this account that we have here. Another example of that later on in Acts, we see, of course, Paul and Silas when they were in prison. They didn't escape in the exact same way, but a man's prison was certainly not something that could hold the apostles of the Lord if that was not the Lord's will. And of course, we see, you know, many examples of Paul and his escapes and even Christ and his escapes too at times, until it got to the point where those prophecies were going to be fulfilled, and Christ's true purpose of coming to this earth was going to be fulfilled by him dying on the cross and then being resurrected. And one point to keep that I want to point out that stands out to me as well in this, in verse 5 there, where we're told Peter was therefore kept in prison, but constant prayer was offered to God for him by the church. We see the power of prayer here. We see the willingness of God to answer prayer, and I think that's something that we certainly need to keep in mind. Here in the country that we live in, fortunately, we have the freedom to gather and to worship and to practice our religion as we see fit, and to practice our faith, although that's being hindered more and more. That's one of the things we're talking about in our Bible class on Wednesday night currently, is the kind of secularization of society and how that's impacted the church and impacted us as Christians. But we need to remember there are those all over the world that don't have those freedoms that we do, that don't have the ability as we do to so easily meet, and they are certainly threatened physically in places where we don't have to worry about that. And it's certainly appropriate and needed to pray for those individuals that are under that persecution, that are in chains, and that are going through those trials and tribulations because of the faith that they proclaim and they practice.
It's important to remember when talking about prayer as well that they're praying for James as well, and he died, and that may raise some questions and all, but they didn't stop praying. They didn't stop trusting in God, and it's not right for us to question God's judgment on matters, though we may wonder what's going on here, but we continue to trust in him. And while certainly evil killed James, there would have been some good that came out of it as they realized he's a faithful man, and also he died for Christ, would have motivated people to be faithful to death as well, and they continued to put their faith in God, and you know that was why. And, you know, the text makes it very apparent that this was a work of God and an answer of prayer that led to Peter's release. And so, you know, prayer is not just some magical thing where it's always going to be the answer that we desire, but we don't stop praying. That's what Jesus asked. Well, will we find faith on earth? Are we going to have that kind of faith to pray incessantly and always trust that God knows what's best for us regardless of what things are going on?
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. You know, we've never been guaranteed those things in this life, and that's why the focus is there, the hope of heaven, because that is guaranteed, regardless of whether our prayers are answered in the way we want them to be in this life, for whether it's, you know, in this example of persecution, even to the point of death, whether it's sickness. You know, we talk about the prayers for the sick, and God works in those ways, and He will heal, but if He healed everybody every time that you pray for, we'd never die. You know, and we know that's not what we are guaranteed, is that physical life. But those that are Christians and those that are faithful, we are guaranteed that no matter what happens, if that prayer to heal physically, even if it's not answered in that moment and we do pass from this life, that hope of heaven is what we are guaranteed, that no one can take away from us if we are faithful to Him. And so certainly important to understand the power of prayer and to have the faith to continue to do that, even when the Lord answers in a way that we don't think is best or that we want. And that's certainly sometimes difficult, but we've got to put our faith in the wisdom of God and not trust our own wisdom and our own understanding. And so the question that we have over this set of verses is, what does it mean in verse 11? There in verse 11, I'll reread that real quickly. And when Peter had come to himself, he said, "Now I know for certain that the Lord has sent an angel and has delivered me from the hand of Herod and from all the expectation of the Jewish people." So what does it mean in verse 11 that Peter had come to himself?
He was in the middle of the street. he didn't go back to sleep. He was wide awake. Well, I think that's what it was talking about. He fully realized that he had been rescued from radicals.
Certainly. Yeah, whatever state he was in, there in verse 6, you know, again, we speculate a little bit the specifics of this, but that's not important as to exactly how it happened. What we understand is that in verse 6, it says, "That night Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains. The guards before the door were keeping him in prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shone in the prison, and he struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, 'Arise quickly,' and his chains fell off his hands." Now, you know, at that point, to what, you know, state of consciousness Peter was in, we're not entirely sure. But there in verse 11, you know, something changed to where now he may not have been quite 100% fully aware as it was happening. Said it happened like a vision. He thought he was seeing a vision there in verse 9, where we're told that. But then when he came to himself, he was fully aware now of what was going on. And all of a sudden he knew he was in prison, chained up, and now he's free. And so that caused him to realize that there was no doubt that it was an angel that had what he thought he saw in a vision actually happened. And he was now freed. And he knew that it was the Lord's doing. And this, again, this also, you know, points to the miraculous nature. This confirms without a doubt the miraculous nature of this event as it happened. And again, we see God working here. And again, to kind of compare that to today and to make that application to today. Today, you know, God works providentially. We understand that. We understand that miracles do not exist anymore, but that prayer is nonetheless no less effective and no less heard when we pray to God, and we are guaranteed that hope of heaven regardless of what might happen in our physical life. Any other comments or questions on that point of the chapter before we move on to the next? All right, continuing on there, I'm going to go ahead and read now verses 12 through 12 through 20. But let's just make it through 19. 12 through 19 to finish up this section. So when he had considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. And as Peter knocked at the door of the gate, a girl named Rhoda came to answer. And when she answered Peter's voice, when she recognized Peter's voice because of her gladness, she did not open the gate, but ran in and mentioned that Peter stood before the gate. But they said to her, "You are beside yourself." Yet you kept insisting that it was so. So they said, "It is an angel," or "It is his angel." Excuse me. Now Peter continued knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. But motioning to them with his hand to keep silent, he declared to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, "Go, tell these things to James and to the brethren." And he departed and went to another place. Then as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers about what had become of Peter. But when Herod had searched for him and not found him, he examined the guards and commanded that they should be put to death. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there. Again, there, you know, Herod put to death those guards that were there when Peter escaped. And again, I think that this is part of what just kind of shows us the disdain that Herod had for those of the faith and how mad he was that this had happened. And how emotional he's acting here in this account towards those of the faith, and again right here towards the soldiers. And so when we look at this, the question we want to answer: why did the disciples, first of all, not believe Rhoda when she said that Peter was at the gate? They said it is his angel there in verses 13 through 15. So why didn't they believe her? First of all, It's interesting, and I'm, kind of makes me laugh a little bit reading this and seeing her reaction. She recognized Peter's voice. Instead of opening it and greeting him, she runs away. She was so excited that it was Peter that she forgot to open the door for him, and she just went and she wanted to tell everybody and wanted to let them know that he was there. But why did they not believe her when she told them that it was Peter at the gate?
Yes. Maybe it was because of the time of day. Surely they had faith that the Lord would answer their prayers if he would. But maybe they had a preconceived notion that it would be during the daytime that he would be released. Mm-hmm. They weren't anticipating a miracle, obviously. But there's a real lesson here, though. When you ask God to do something and he does it, don't be surprised.
Right.
Expect it. Get it. Thank you.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly. Ask God to do something, and when it's answered, be on the lookout for it, be expecting it. And especially, again, because when those prayers are answered, they're not always answered in the way that we might think they should be. And so if we are so focused on something the way we think it should be done, we could miss the great blessing opportunity that God presents for us. Because we're, again, focusing on and counting on our own wisdom instead of God's. Did you have something, Naomi?
Yeah. I was just going to say that when the disciples said that it is an angel, it just reminded me of when Jesus was crucified, but then he came back to the benefit of them. It just reminds me of that instance, because that's what they saw. So they were like, well, maybe this is just part two of it or something.
Yeah.
Right,
when Jesus appeared to him out of nowhere, he appeared to him and he was gone. And so they thought, yeah, perhaps it was his angel. And again, they say, Peter's angel. So yeah, they were kind of anticipating something other than what actually happened. They didn't recognize that this miraculous thing had been done. And so, they knew Peter was in prison, right? I believe so. I mean, I may be reading into that, but when we talk about, let's see, yeah, that's a little speculation. I mean, I'm assuming that they knew he was in prison, but in verse 3 there, because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter. This was something that was done publicly, and they were praying for him, so we know that he was, they knew he was there, but they weren't aware yet that he had been miraculously released, and so they doubted her when she first said that. But yeah, certainly a lesson to understand that we need to have that faith that prayer is going to be answered, and be looking for that and aware of those things. Anything else before we get into the last few verses of this? Yes, Isaiah?
I just thought it was a bit of a little bit of a
right.
It's the daytime, it's a prisoner or whatever. So it seems like him doing it the way he did is his way of trying to reassure people that were praying for Peter to alleviate any doubt that their prayers were heard, they were answered. Right. But, you know, in a way that would, that they might have some doubt that maybe it was at least by coincidence or chance.
Certainly. Yeah, and I think we see the wisdom here. We understand the purpose of prayer, right? Or the purpose of miracles, excuse me. The reason that the miracles existed at this time was to, you know, confirm that these men, these apostles, were truly speaking the word of God, that they were truly inspired, and that there was no question. And so, yeah, this is an opportunity that God uses to show that and to reaffirm that. And we see the impact that it had. You know, there in verse 17, he told them to keep silent there, that they were immediately. He said, though, go and tell these things to James and to the brethren. And so they wanted this to be made known, in part to know just that Peter was free. He wasn't there anymore, but also because of the miraculous nature of this, I believe. And then also there in verse 10, not only among the followers, but among those that weren't faithful. And as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers about what had become of Peter. I mean, these guards, this was their job. This is not something that happened quite often. You know, prisoners didn't just escape, on occasion from prison. And that's another, you know, that's one of the reasons why Herod was so mad that this happened and had them killed, was because this was something that the punishment for this was death. If you were, you know, you let this happen on your account and on your watch. And so, you know, this miraculous thing where Peter was released from prison and was escaped from prison with the help of the angel, this is certainly something that caused those soldiers to question. Now, how many of them did that lead to them becoming faithful? We don't know. Perhaps a couple of them did because of this event. But at the very least, it caused them to question things and talk about things. And again, we see the effect that the miracles had here and why they were done, why they were used in this way. And so that gets us to now, more specifically, Herod and what happens to Herod.
I always thought growing up this was a fun passage to read about the worms and everything. Some of the girls didn't like it as much as the guys, I think, growing up. You got something to add, Jeremiah? Go ahead.
Well, you know, it says in verse 19 that he searched, when Herod had searched for him and not found him, he examined the guards. And I think that, you know, to your point about miracles and what the kind of faith that it would provide and such and their purpose, it also, I think, this text manifests the obstinacy of men like Herod, and that nothing would convince them, because he's put on horns of a dilemma, I think, here, where there's only two options. As he examines the guards, they don't have any idea how Peter got out. But I think one thing would be consistent is they're adamant they didn't release him. I mean, that's by penalty of death already, so they would not admit to releasing him. And so either a miracle occurred, because he's kept by four squads of soldiers on rotation. I mean, there's no way a man gets out of that except by divine intervention. So either a miracle occurred, this man is a prophet of God, you know, an apostle of Christ, and all of this is legitimate, or these guards are conspiring together and they released him. And that's illogical, because they would have known the penalty for that would be their lives. And so, you know, Herod's kind of really given no choice, either believe a miracle has occurred or completely harden your heart against this, and he killed innocent men in that regard. So, I mean, you remember in Luke 16 how, you know, the rich man was convinced that if Lazarus went to his brothers from the grave, that surely they would believe. And he said, Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets. And so, I mean, a hard heart is just not going to be penetrated by truth if it doesn't want to be. And you see the evil in a man like Herod. And if that's the way that a man wants to go, that's exactly the way he's going to go.
Definitely. It's not the first time we've seen it from the leaders. You know, back in Acts 4, when Peter and John were arrested, in verse 16, the council, they conferred among themselves, saying, what shall we do of these men? For indeed, a notable miracle has been done through them, is evident to all who dwell in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. You know, they couldn't deny it. They were admitting right here that the miracle happened. They could not deny it. But then they said, so that it doesn't spread further, let's threaten them. And that's when they told them, commanded them to neither speak nor teach. You know, Peter said, well, you know, we've got to obey God rather than men, because they continue to go on and preach, of course, as we see happens later on throughout the chapter. So, yeah, that's one thing that never ceases to amaze me, is the hardness of the hearts and how men can just, with all the evidence in their face and all the logic there, and still not only deny it or choose not to believe it, but then to actively fight against it. And to think that they're going to, in the end, be able to win out. You know, you see this miracle happen and thinking, oh, I can still overcome. And again, it just shows the hardness of their hearts, one, and then the absolute arrogance that man has, and that we see certainly today in our society. Yes, Dennis.
Hi, Patrick, who I go to is Peter. This great miracle was done by Paul would have heard about it, of course. But I think it was especially done for Peter. When he was sitting there in that jail, and James had just been killed, what was going through his mind?
Well, I'm sure he thought he was next. And at least the thought crossed his mind.
I saw that too. But then, on the shores of Galilee, what did Jesus say to him? You'll be old when you die.
That's right.
He told him three times, feed my sheep. So I think what the Lord was doing here, it was just the Lord who released him. What he was doing here was putting emphasis on his purpose, what the Lord had for him to do. And so that, I'm pretty sure he got past the denial after meeting Jesus in the
right.
But that's something that's going to haunt you. You know, it's going to pop up. Like Paul's persecution of the church, that haunted him the rest of his life, and probably had a lot to do with driving him to work as hard as he did. Same for you.
Good point. All right, so now in verses, we'll go ahead and just read the end of the chapter, and then instead of breaking it up, it's only five verses left, or six verses. But beginning there in verse 20, now Herod had been very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, but they came to him with one accord, and having made Blastus the king's personal aide their friend, they asked for peace because their country was supplied with food by the king's country. So on a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne and gave an oration to them. And the people kept shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." And then immediately an angel of the Lord struck him, because he did not give glory to God. And he was eaten by worms and died, but the word of God grew and multiplied. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry. And they also took with them John, whose surname was Mark. And so, again, we see that God takes the life of King Herod. And the question there is why? Why does God take the life of Herod, based on what we read here in this passage?
When they said the voice of a god, he didn't deny it.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, I put blasphemy, arrogance, you know. I think it's pretty obvious too, the harm that Herod was doing to the church was not something that God was willing to allow to continue at this point. And so, you know, all those things combined, but certainly the absolute, again, blasphemy there and arrogance. Here he is in royal apparel, sitting on his throne, speaking, and you know, you can just picture the kings throughout the ages, and we see even the political leaders of our day. They're not kings, but they very much are, you know, act as they are more important than they really are. A lot of them. We see it with celebrities, but just the arrogance, the blasphemy. They called him a god, and he didn't deny it. You know, you contrast that to the apostles when they were, you know, the people after miraculous healings and miracles that were done claimed that they were God, and they said, no, you know, we're just a man, and they continually gave God the glory. And we certainly see the opposite of that happening here.
Do you have something?
Certainly, you know, it reminds me of Romans 1, you know, passage we referred to, worshiping the creature rather than the creator. We see that today. You know, why is man so unwilling and more secular and more unwilling to accept God? We see our nation and our world becoming more and more antagonistic to God, fewer and fewer people that believe in God. And it's because they put themselves on a pedestal. They are their God, and they worship themselves. And again, it's not quite as public as what we see here with Herod, but it's the same attitude. And ultimately, in the end, it's going to be the same consequence. You know, again, God doesn't work in miraculous ways. He's not going to strike people with worms in their belly today, but they will receive their just punishment. On judgment and that eternal damnation that comes from that blasphemy and that arrogance and that lack of subjecting themselves to God.
As well, I think, to his point, Daniel 5, you know, it was done to him that he may know that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And I think this would have been, you know, how immediate they would have known that this was from God and judgment of him. I mean, Luke is recording it, so eventually they understand by this divine record that was an act of God against Herod, and he rules in the kingdom of men. I mean, this is a slightly different beast than what they're used to. Now this is a political figure that is harassing the church, and you know, that would kind of be the new scene as the gospel is brought to the Gentiles and spread across the world, and we know the history of the church and the persecution they received from Rome and all of that kind of stuff. And God rules in the kingdom of men, and he's going to be in control, and he sees everything that's happening to his people. And if it's not in this life, like you were saying, it's going to be in the judgment, that there will be retribution. And that certainly would have been cause for a growth of faith in the people of God when they realized that this man was judged by God. There was a consequence to his actions against, you know, the Lord's church.
Yeah, and speaking of that increase in faith due to this and the benefit that would have to those followers of Christ, you know, the contrast, and that's our next question. It talks about the contrast between the death of Herod there in verse 23, and then immediately in verse 24 it says, but the word of God grew and multiplied. And so the question is, what is intended between the contrast here? And I think, again, it's in part what Jeremiah said, that we see that the faith was encouraged of those, you know, that saw this and knew that the Lord was in control and on their side and working in the affairs of men. This was confirmation of that. It shows that God's will shall always be done, no matter how. And again, I think that's a great lesson that we can look at today. And back in Matthew 10, when Jesus is giving his disciples instructions to go out and preach, he warns them of these persecutions. And Peter was there in Matthew 10 when he was warning them. And so this is nothing that was going to, you know, nothing that surprised the apostles. They were expecting it. But perhaps this persecution is coming as a little bit more of a surprise, maybe the intensity of it. You know, again, we understand we're going to have persecution. I think, you know, again, we in America, with the country we live in, if we all of a sudden had to, you know, our lives were being taken because of our faith, that would be something that would you know, be a shock to the system in some ways. So we see the encouragement that they get here from this happening and the word growing and the word multiplying. But it's important to understand that no matter what the world does, no matter how bad the persecution is, God's will is going to be done. The church will continue. And we've got to make sure that we do our part in spreading the word. Why did the word grow and multiply? Well, there's only one way it can. It's because it was preached. It was taught. They used this. And when you see these things happen, you can kind of go two different ways, right? Okay, we're being persecuted. These terrible things are happening. I'm going to, you know, crawl into my hole and just hide and keep a low profile for a while. Or we can go out and we can fight that spiritual battle. And we can, you know, spread the word and we can try to impact and influence as many people, teach as many people as possible. That's one of the things we've talked about a little bit in that Wednesday night class. You know, the focus should be on the spiritual battle. We can get, you know, kind of bogged down and maybe, you know, trick ourselves into thinking we're doing good by how we vote and how we, you know, we're involved in politics or school boards or those public, those secular institutions. But the world's the world, and it's always going to be the world. It's always going to be evil. And the way that we make a difference is by preaching the word. And again, you know, using that, those persecutions, you know, those can be a motivation in a way to go into to become more dedicated to doing that. Jeff, something you want to add real quick?
Well, and that's what that last verse, you know, said Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem. They, at the end of chapter 11, they had brought the gift from Antioch to the needy saints, you know, talking about the Agabus and his prophecy of the famine, and they sealed that gift to them. They returned. So, I mean, they may have been in town when all this is happening, and when they leave, they don't leave with their tail between their legs, not going to do anything. They're going to preach. They're going to keep on spreading the gospel. And all of these events sort of solidified their faith and helped them have that courage.
Certainly.
And so, you know, that we're pretty much out of time real quickly. The last question says, explain the relationship of Barnabas and Saul with John Mark. So we see there that they took John Mark with them. He worked there with them, assisted them in the gospel, is what it says there. I believe in maybe it's Colossians where it says he, anyway, he assisted in their gospel efforts. We read that John Mark was the cousin of Barnabas. And then later on there in Acts 15, which we'll talk about as we get into a few chapters, we see a little bit of controversy surrounding John Mark, where Paul didn't want to take him with them. It was because John Mark departed them when they were in Pamphylia there in Acts chapter 15 and verse 38. And so there was some contention there between Paul and Barnabas that ultimately caused for them to separate. For a while, Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, and Paul chose Silas and went through Syria and Cilicia in his journey. And so just the relationship there a little bit between those three, and that's some, we'll be talking a little bit more about that in some chapters to come. Appreciate your comments and your attention. Again, next week we'll be on Acts chapter 13, and hopefully Dad's back will be better.